Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, actor Jim Parsons, star of The Big Bang Theory, on how he learned to become funny.
There was something about the farce aspect that allowed me to connect at a very, very honest level. The situation was so absurd that I didn't have any fear of accidentally revealing anything about myself because it was obvious this wasn't me.
At one point in his career, Jim Parsons was among the highest paid actors on television. He turned an awkward super genius named Sheldon into an iconic character on The Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang Theory lasted 12 seasons, and Jim Parsons won 4 Emmys for his performance. But though many people might associate Jim with such a goofy character, you might be surprised to discover that he is a trained stage actor in the tradition of Beckett, Chekhov, and Shakespeare. In fact, as a young man, Jim was admitted into one of the most prestigious acting programs in the U.S. On this episode of The Great Creators, you'll find out how studying Shakespeare helped Jim dissect, then deliver Sheldon's dense scientific monologues. You'll hear how he gives depth to unlikable characters, why he doesn't judge them, and how he tries to make them whole. And the story of how he found his creative footing after leaving the secure routine of a massive hit TV show. That's all coming up after a quick break.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Jim Parsons is one of those people who just knew early in his life what he wanted to be when he grew up, like really early. He was about 4 years old, living in Houston, Texas, when he announced to his parents that he was going to be a movie star, and he wasted no time putting that dream into action.
I imagine it had a lot to do with what I saw on TV, if not in total, although we did go to the movies, but and certainly more as I grew up. I knew that I wanted to speak in front of people, that, and I guess I felt comfortable doing it, but it's not even what I remember. It was more of a need, a desire. It felt like a good use of me, even way back when my parents had their little home video recorder, and I would take the mic and just guide me and my sister through whatever footage they were going to take. By the age of 5 or 6, I was in my first play, and so there was a constructive and instructive outlet for that energy very early in my life. And And I ebbed and flowed in it as far as whether I was going to continue, but it was pretty much a constant, even with some hiccups, yeah.
And I mean, constant, right through high school in Houston. And I should mention, Houston's got a massive number of theater, like a huge theater system.
Yes.
I think, right? It's like after New York.
It might be after New York and Chicago.
Yeah.
But in general, it has, and I didn't kind of realize this until I moved away from Houston, was what a large cultural scene it is in all art forms, be it theater or the opera or museums. I have a very close friend who I went to college with, and she and I both moved to New York right after college. And the more and more people we met in New York, it really made us realize how many cultural things like that we were exposed to. And I hate to say it, but I think there was part of me that wrote off Houston like anybody else would have. Like, yeah. If you really want to do it, you go to New York, whatever.
New York, yeah.
Yeah. And I've really realized how much I got out of living in Houston.
Jim, as a teenager, I mean, as you know, we're roughly the same age, and we sort of came of age where, you know, it was just kind of the beginning of a moment when young men and women who were gay could start to feel a little bit comfortable, but still very, very challenging. What do you remember about your experience as a kid in high school? I mean, did you? How do you remember feeling about yourself, your sexuality, who you were?
I had a girlfriend through a majority of high school. I had a best friend who would eventually also be gay, but it wasn't a topic we were broaching at the time. I really think, in all honesty, I just thought it might go away. I the relationship with the girlfriend, how do you say this without being too graphic? It wasn't devoid of intimacy in that way. Yeah. And so I this is so personal. I mean, not literally, but I mean, it's just so funny. I look at it now going, well, that's because I was so young. I mean,
yeah.
Just...
yeah.
Anyway, but I really, it wasn't until I got to college that I was able to understand that I could see the world in color as opposed to black and white, which I did not realize until I kind of couldn't ignore certain feelings I was having. And that was actually a wonderful moment, if scary. But in high school, I just was pretty full of denial, and I couldn't imagine anything more inconvenient, not to mention painful. You know, I look back now, and I did not think this at the time, but I see it very clearly now, how much there was that subconscious, verging unconscious part of me that really feared coming out would mean to sever and lose all the relationships that I had, from family to close friends. I didn't, even though the world was changing, it didn't seem like it was changing for me personally. It was more something I could observe.
Did you grow up with any religious faith at home?
We were Lutheran, and we went to church most Sundays. I was confirmed in the church. Mm-hmm. Again, now that I'm older, I look back on some parts of that with a great fondness. I mean, being an actor, growing up in the theater, I definitely enjoy ritual. It's very theatrical, church can be.
Right.
But I will tell you, I remember specifically, I think it was during college. I think it was still during high school. Either way, but I remember at some point there was this prayer we used to say, and the pastor would say something, and our refrain was always, please forgive me. Maybe not have been exactly that, but it was something like that. And it was over and over and over. And I realized at some point, I beat myself up all the time. I don't know that the healthiest thing for me is to come here and say out loud again and again, please forgive me for what the horrible person I am.
Yeah.
Maybe that's blasphemous, but it's okay.
Did you? I read that when you were in high school, your parents, I think your dad was a bit more supportive of your pursuit of acting, but your mom was concerned. It's not, I mean, understandably, yeah. This is not a stable life to enter into.
No.
Like, the odds are against you. You are most likely not going to make it. The graveyard of failed actors is much bigger than the, you know, the pantheon of successful actors.
Yeah. No, I think about it frequently. They were both very supportive of my pursuit of it, and they were both vocal that they thought that I was good at what I was doing, but he was either literally less afraid of me trying it or less vocal about me, or more insistent that, I mean, the phrase I remember him saying in front of my mother, I can't remember how I heard this, or maybe she told me, he told her, which was like, why did we create an opportunity for our children to go off to college if we're not going to let them, or whatever it was, into the world,
yeah.
if we're not going to let them pursue and try the thing that's calling to them, which was a very loving and mature thing to say at the same time, enlightened almost. And that quickly got her on board. But yeah, when she heard that I wanted to switch my major from radio and television to theater after my first year in college, she was not apoplectic, but it was it wasn't the good news she was hoping for.
I mean, it's a life of struggle, right? Especially if you try and break into theater. What was it about being on stage? And it's, I mean, I'm sort of foreshadowing a bit, because we'll talk about this later, of course. Sort of ironically, you sort of became famous in a comedic role. But really, that wasn't what you were attracted to or what you were doing. I mean, you did musicals, you did Guys and Dolls, but you were doing Beckett and Chekhov and Shakespeare. I mean, you were a dramatic actor. I think that's what you were attracted to, right?
It was what I was attracted to, certainly. That was what was the kind of stuff that had the impact on me that made me want to do it. By the same token, I did know from a very early age that I knew that I had some sort of natural feel for the rhythms of certain comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of it was I had grown up musical. We had a piano in the house, which I crawled up and started plunking out tunes on from a very early age. And so I think as much as anything, when I say about the rhythm in comedy, it's just a musicality that I was drawn to. But I also grew up watching so many sitcoms, and because, I mean, they were on the air all the time, and I loved watching the reruns of the old ones. And I was very fortunate. I had gotten a role in one of the few remaining at the time multicam sitcoms, because the rhythms of that multicam format I had grown up with and been schooled in without even realizing they were teaching me. And it was just something that some part of my subconscious understood. But going back real quick, long before that, my first big breakthroughs in high school were in comedic roles. I remember we did a farce called Noises Off, and I could tell something different was going on that had ever gone on for me before in acting. And I've thought a lot about that through the years, and I really do feel strongly that there was something about the farce aspect that allowed me to connect at a very, very honest level. The situation was so absurd that I didn't have any fear of accidentally revealing anything about myself, because it was obvious this wasn't me. And I guess the irony was that I could really be me. It was something about the ridiculousness of the farce that really unlocked something for me about being honest on stage.
As a very, very young man, I think like right around the time you were in college, you founded or co-founded an avant-garde theater company in Houston, Infernal Bridegroom Productions, and you guys produced a bunch of plays.
Yes.
And you described some of them as awfully dark, or many of them as awfully dark.
They could be, yes.
Tell me about that project. I mean, that's super entrepreneurial to do, but also obviously a creative outlet.
Yeah, I was not an entrepreneur. I was going to say I was a terrible business person, but I was so far from even trying to be that I couldn't even be terrible at it. I was in my undergraduate had a master class with a director named Jose Quintero, and you had to audition for it and get in. And I got in, and one of the older students that was in there, he was part of the group that was putting together this theater troupe, and he watched me perform something in the class, and he told the director and asked me that he thought I should audition for, they were doing Samuel Beckett's Endgame. And so I said, sure. And I drove over to this warehouse and I auditioned and I got cast and I started working with them. I think the big thing that happened for me was when I read Endgame before the audition, I'll never forget the feeling. I hadn't read it before and I hadn't seen it before. And so it wasn't exactly like, I feel like I've read this, but there was something so familiar about it. And there was something so elemental that I connected to in it. I mean, it's a study in what the ultimate essence of being alive and humanity and codependency and whatever. But, it spoke to me. And that was kind of the thing with everything I did with that group and why we kept working together, I think, as much as we did is because those were the kinds of plays they were doing.
And you were mounting these at small theaters in Houston, right?
Well, not even. Normally it was like at a warehouse or in a parking lot or mm-hmm. things like that. At a like a picnic grounds or whatever. Yeah.
And this was like the primary thing you did in the years after you graduated from college.
Yes, I graduated in 96, and for the next 2 years, I think I did 17 productions with them in those 2 years, and I mostly worked at Whole Foods as a cashier. At some point, I quit that because I got cast. They did this summer children's theater, and I got in all three of the shows they were doing, and so it was enough pay to compete with my cashier salary, and so I was able to stop cashiering. But then at the end of those 2 years, I started getting hungry to figure out what was next for me. If I was ever going to make a shot at paying my rent fully through acting, I didn't see how I was going to do it in Houston. And so I knew that I had to move. So I auditioned for grad schools.
You got into this program at the University of San Diego that is, I think it works in partnership with the Old Globe Theater in San
Diego. That's right.
For people who don't know about it, it's super, super like prestigious. They accept like 10 students or something like seven a year. So it's like, if you're like an athlete, it's like getting into Division I, you know, the Division I football team. I mean, and I wonder getting into a program like that, is that pretty much a ticket to success in New York or LA or?
No.
Or not? No.
No. No. No. It's so crazy. No, it's not at all. It was jumping ahead of the process of being there. What the thing that they were really good at, the director of our program at the time was really good about getting us to a showcase in New York and LA that enough agents and industry people would come to. And that is how I got my agent. So in that way, it was a definite possible ticket to getting the very first door open to maybe get an audition somewhere with a legitimate agency behind you. And that did make an enormous difference. I mean, in some ways it may have made all the difference. But I certainly had friends in the program who didn't get an agent out of it. I had other friends who did, who maybe aren't doing it now. You know, a ton of different things.
Were you primarily doing Shakespeare while you were in that program?
No. It is, there is an intensity in Shakespeare in this program. I remember at my audition for the program, I did one contemporary monologue and I did one Shakespearean monologue. Mm-hmm. And I remember the head of the program, Rick was his name. And Rick said, there's not a lot of Shakespeare on here. And I said, no. And I didn't say anything else because I thought, I'm not going to give myself enough rope to hang myself with. Let's just get out of the room and hope for the best. So I feel like, at least in that small way, I was kind of honest about, I'm not sure how much Shakespeare is my interest. I will tell you this, though. I would recommend a program intensive on Shakespeare to any actor out there, whether you ever do it again or not. It is unlike anything else, and I just feel like it served me. It showed me a pathway to dissecting the most dense, thick text that there was, and honestly served me very well in the specific sitcom I actually landed in. The density, especially in the early years of Big Bang, the density of some of those science monologues that I had to deliver were, or got to deliver, I guess that's what the grateful person says, that I got to deliver. They reminded me nothing so much as they did of working on the Shakespeare stuff. I was like, how am I gonna, okay, break it down.
I'm curious. I'm really curious about theater, because I think, I mean, you graduated from this program, and I know that you graduated, and right around the time that you finished this program, your father was tragically killed. He passed away when you were like 28, late 20s. And he was a young man. He was 52.
It looks younger every year, his age. It's
right,
so crazy.
As you get closer to it, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were starting a career. You went to New York. And did you go to New York with the intention of being a theater actor? Was that the plan in your mind?
I don't think – no, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I did focus on New York because up to then I had only done theater. And I thought, I don't feel – it's so funny looking back, though, at decisions I was making as, when was that, 20-something years ago now. But, and like, what was I thinking?
Although right, because L.A. would have been the place to go.
L.A. would have been the place to go. I just felt that for me, I just thought, why would I go someplace that has so much less theater than a place that has so much theater when that's what I've done? And while I want to do other things besides theater, I really just want to work as soon as I can. I would love to put off having to take another job, quote unquote, as long as I can. If maybe that could be forever. It didn't end up being forever, but yeah, I went to New York thinking it was safer for me. Also, I had friends there, and I had visited there, and I really, really liked it. And I didn't know a lot about LA, even though I'd been there.
Yeah. So you got there, and what, you started to audition for anything and everything, right, as much as possible from New York?
Yeah. I got there, and I auditioned very quickly. I got my agent, and then I auditioned for an off-Broadway play, and I got it. And it was pretty far off Broadway, and it didn't pay very much. But it was really important to me at the time, because I see it now more clearly. I felt that I was working immediately, and I was meeting people, and I wasn't trying to fill a Rolodex, but I mean, I see it in retrospect now of like, I was working with other actors who had all done jobs either off Broadway or on Broadway on film. They were in this play too. And it made it feel organic as opposed to a struggle, you know, because, I mean, until you get a financially good job as an actor, the finances are always going to be a struggle unless you come from wealth or whatever else. But so that was not gone. But what was gone was the struggle of the feeling of like, am I ever going to get cast in something now that I've gotten out of school? And that was the luckiest thing that could have happened to me. I think I see that now.
When we come back in just a moment, how that lucky break multiplies as Jim's career goes from off-Broadway to a soundstage in L.A. to becoming one of television's highest-paid sitcom stars. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. So it's the early 2000s, and Jim is auditioning for TV shows and sitcoms and securing pretty big commercials. He even gets cast in a movie, Garden State. But it's becoming clear that if he wants to get to the next level, he's going to have to leave New York. All right, you were living in New York in the early 2000s, and you met this guy, Todd Spiewak, who you would eventually date and then marry. And Todd is, of course, now a pretty well-known producer. I guess it was Todd who convinced you that you needed to move to L.A. in 2004, that he was saying, look, this is really where you need to be if this is the work you want to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He had watched me. He had watched all of my financial jobs were the ones that I would go out to L.A. and work and make some money and then come back and just sit around
and
you know, for a few months at a time. Yeah. And then we did the pilot for Big Bang, and it didn't get picked up, but we were going to shoot it again and see if it got picked up. And that was the window in which he said, you should go whether or not, I mean, we should go before we know it's picked up, because if it gets picked up, you'll need to be out there. And if it doesn't get picked up, I think you need to spend time out there, you know. He was always very oddly intuitive about my personal relationship to the industry. He used to work at a graphic design firm that was like two doors down from my agency. And so anytime I would get an audition, he would offer to go by on his way home and pick it up and then bring it to me. And he would usually read it in the cab on the way home. And he would almost to each one know when it was something I was going to get. He'd be like, this is very good for you. Huh. I'd be like, okay.
I mean, you know, for people who know a little bit about you, you auditioned twice for The Big Bang Theory and got it, of course, got that role. But I wonder, when you first read that script, clearly you thought it was something special. Did you have any sense of what it would become? It became a massive show, one of the biggest shows in television
history.
No idea.
What I connected to was that I knew that this was, I thought this was a good part for me. Mm. I think I understand what they're doing with this, and I would never say I should get a role, but I will be willing to say I should be down to the last five for this one. I should be in the final circle for this one, you know, and then we can get particular in what, maybe it's a look thing or who knows what. But that was one of those that I thought I should be in the finals for this one. But as far as, no, I didn't know how to gauge that. I still don't think I would know how to gauge that. I know that I don't. But I did know that what was happening on that soundstage in front of that live audience, it was working. It was connecting. It was being well done, both from the writers and the actors and everybody else. But that just didn't feel like a guarantee at all.
I think a couple of years before that, you had auditioned for The Office, right?
I did. I auditioned for both the Jim character and the Rainn Wilson character. I can't remember.
Wow.
I think I did both of them. Yeah.
Wow.
Which is an interesting point of how things work.
Totally. Yeah.
I remember I felt good about going in for those. I felt that I could belong in an ensemble like that, but it wasn't the same specific connectivity to either role that I felt, say, when I first read Sheldon.
Which is interesting because Sheldon isn't really a lovable character at first glance, right? He's pretty difficult. I mean, he clearly doesn't grasp social norms. He's a little bit arrogant. He's rude. So what was it about this character that you thought, I love this character, I can become this character?
I think a lot of it had to do with the opportunity to fight against exactly what you're listing there. It's playing the opposite. It's filling the space that's not being filled by the writing. And that was what was so much fun about getting to put that character on, as it were, was just this. It really felt like it was the opportunity to make him whole by giving him a heart and by giving him hurt. I almost didn't say that word because I thought, oh, Jim, that sounds so hopelessly deep. But, you know, whatever. That's the truth. It's how I felt. And no, I didn't try to, you know, it's a sitcom. I realize that it's a comedy. But it really was. It was all those, it was like that was what made it worth playing in a lot of ways. And that was really a huge part of the fun, was getting to try and play those things underneath all of those scientific words and situations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so many challenging things about that role. The science, for one thing, and the show is lauded for being so scientifically accurate. But the pace and the rhythm of the dialogue. I mean, there's some moments where you were just like, I don't even know how you memorized all the words you had to say. And it's physical. Like, there's a physical movement to your body and these tics and these expressions. Yeah. And I wonder how you prepare to play that character, or any character, but that character in particular, I can't imagine is easy. I mean, I think it was probably incredibly challenging to play that character on so many levels.
Yeah, it was. Here's the deal, though. I don't think my version of fun is the same version that most people think of when they say fun. But I'm not sure if that's true or not. I just know that there can be a certain tortured aspect to the joy that I'm having. And working on that role, especially the first few years, the time spent locked at home going through things sometimes did verge on a little bit of madness. But I just loved, I loved the puzzle about it. And I loved, you know, I guess I was prideful in the way I loved getting to show up and going, I did it. I know it. I can do it. I can execute. And again, it's such a specific energy. And coming out of the show for a few years now, I certainly intellectually knew that because I had worked before, but like 12 years is a long time. And I'm seeing... Yeah. I see certain things a little more clearly, I guess, certainly differently with each day that passes by. And it was just, it wasn't a way of working that I would want to work all the time anymore. Yeah. Or even then, probably, but yeah.
Well, was it the intensity or the pace or both? Or?
Well, I guess all that played into it, but it was strenuous in a way that stripped away a certain level of playfulness, maybe. That's not completely fair. It was a specific way of working and a specific type of playfulness. And right now I'm reaching for things, I think, that ask me to play in a different way. I don't know. The word mystery keeps coming to me. It's not that there weren't certain mysteries. There's always a mystery when you step onto a stage to do something. But like, there was a certain rigidity to the machine of filming that show and working on that show.
Well, it had to be because it was so big. It was a massive business. I mean, because it became so big.
It's true. It's true. But even the art form itself was more, specific art form itself, that specific genre was built for that kind of precision. And that's why I don't want to say there wasn't playfulness, because there was a ton of playfulness. But the maze, the walls were very tight. And the nice thing there is that when you know your very tight boundaries in there, sometimes it can be much more playful because, you know, well, I know where I can and can't go. And so I'm so aware of it that I actually am very free. But I mean, look, it was also, it's a time limit. It's a, what is it? I think they're down to 22 minutes these days, maybe 21 yeah. of actual airtime.
Right.
And it's just, you got to go, go, go. And that kind of, the kind of comedy we were doing wasn't a meandering type. It was a very, you know, there was a beat to it.
You were doing what, 25 episodes a season?
24, I think. Yeah.
And so that meant that on your days off, you were always working, right? Because you're memorizing your lines and you are
less as
rehearsing.
The years went on. Honestly, less as the years went on. When we first started, I had heard that, you know, the multicam sitcom schedule was the easiest one in the world. If you ever wanted to start a family and you got on a sitcom, do it then.
Right.
And the first few years, I was like, what are they talking about? This is all I do. However, I got more used to the process. We added more characters. My word load kind of went down. And the newness of the gift, as it were, wore off. It's just going to. And so I kind of couldn't, after a certain amount of years, keep doing what I was doing. And at that point, for the last few years of the show, then I really understood what they meant. I mean, oh, this is awful to say out loud. Sometimes it felt like we barely worked at all.
I understand what you mean. Yeah,
but we had gotten.
It
was such a well-oiled machine that it really wouldn't have made a lot of sense to stay there and just keep, because we did it like a play. So we rehearsed all week long and then did pre-shoots for any technical things or tricky scenes on a day before, and then we'd do the whole show on a Tuesday night, and at some point it was just like, we don't need to rehearse this for as many hours as we were doing.
Yeah. I mean, doing anything for 10 years. I mean, MASH was on for 11 years, right? And Big Bang Theory had 12 seasons. At the end of season 12, it's a well-known, you were offered a massive contract to do 13 and season 14, and you turned it down. It was clear to you that it just, you were done.
It was clear. But to be fair, no one had offered anything specifically.
Okay.
There had never been, well, I just mean because that was kind of a level of difficulty that I didn't actually have to face in numbers or figures in front of me or anything. I had gone to New York the summer before that ended up being our final season, and I was doing Boys in the Band on Broadway, and a lot of big events happened for me. The death of a dog, I broke my foot. It was just,
you'd been in Hidden Figures, like you'd done some films.
Yes. And it was just, for me, it was very clear it just was the right time in my life for it to be the last season. And I will tell you honestly that I went back to work thinking, well, they're going to quickly want to know if they have to write a last season, so the contracts will come. Oh my God, we got there. And I thought, oh no, no one's going to say anything. Oh my God. So I wrote to Chuck, Lori, and Steve Millar, the producers, and I said, can we talk? Oh my God. I shouldn't say it was awkward. They were so sweet, and they were always nice to me. So it wasn't that. It was just weird. And I really thought this was one of those times that somebody else would make the first move, you know, shirk some responsibility again. Why don't you? But I really wanted to. I was like, please just say something so I can go, no, I'm not. Thanks. But I guess it was a rough time in that way, you know.
Well, I mean, because of what, I mean, imagine at a certain point you kind of accomplish what you want to accomplish as that character, and you were ready to continue growing as an actor.
Yeah. I mean, that's it on the head.
Right?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
I wonder whether, because when you're in an ensemble, it is like a little bit like a kind of like a business enterprise, right? Especially a show like that. Was there tension with, I don't know, with your other folks on the team who maybe wanted to keep going?
There was. I don't know what they all wanted. You know, I talked more to some than I talked to others. I certainly knew there were some people who were also felt done. It's crazy because, you know, you watch the Beatles documentary or whatever, and it's intense and certainly reminds me. Now I like this, the meme. Jim compares Big Bang to the Beatles. No, that's not what I'm doing. But hold on.
It's an ensemble. You're with the same people for 12 years.
You are, but we didn't start our band together. Right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that is where, like, you used the word the business, and that was what was very tricky to meander through, not knowing where do you go first in this situation. And just the way our situation was, from my perspective at least, it made sense for me to talk to the producers before there was any talk with the cast. But yeah, I mean, there was no way for it not to be. And I don't know if I could have, you know, the other ways you could do it could have been less tense or whatever. But ultimately, it was okay. And we had a great last season together. And
no, I mean, I imagine there's always, it's like, you know, it's like a kind of a version of a family, right? Except there's money involved and there's livelihoods and all these things. And different people are going to come out of it differently. Like,
yeah,
your profile was so, I mean, you'd won four Emmys and obviously some of the actors on that show have gone on to make other shows that are highly acclaimed and excellent. But I can imagine it's fraught. It's a fraught conversation.
Yeah. And it's a big beast, you know. It's hard to a show like that is its own beast, you know, and you don't contend with that in the same way on other things. It's very different.
When we come back in just a moment, how Jim moved away from playing a TV character that defined him to executive producing his own show and taking on dramatic roles drawn from real-life people. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. So in 2019, The Big Bang Theory ended after 12 years. And it meant, in a way, that Jim had to start over and fight being typecast. And to do that, he discovered he had to take chances by saying yes and. You know, I'm really interested in the sort of career that you have developed now. I mean, you're still young and you've got a long career ahead of you, and you've started to pursue a bunch of different things. You're a production company, and you helped, and you really developed young Sheldon. Obviously, you're in that show, not on screen, but as a disembodied voice. And so you still have that connection to the Big Bang Theory. But the roles you have taken on, right? Hollywood agent in the miniseries Hollywood, as the lawyer in the Ted Bundy film, this new role in spoiler alert, these are very different characters. And it's interesting because, you know, I've had versions of this conversation where actors talk about being typecast and the danger of it and the challenge of breaking out of it. And it's almost as if that character or the characters that you were playing, those kind of weird farcical roles, like you've maybe made a conscious decision not to do that for a while.
I'm sure there's some consciousness to it, and maybe a lot of consciousness to it, but so much of it is about just what feels right when
or
I read it or hear it. And I guess that's what I mean when I mean right. You're right, is that this sounds like an interesting next thing to do. But the other part of it, I have to be honest, is how many things come. Like, I loved getting to work on Hollywood. I loved playing that agent in that miniseries. And that was all just Ryan Murphy asked, do you want to do it? And, you know, and the Ted Bundy thing, I got to play that because Joe Berlinger asked, do you want to do it? And so in that way, I don't know how responsible. I mean, I'm emitting something that is signaling to these people that I might be interested, I guess. But other than that, I do feel like my responsibility in those situations is to go, yes, this sounds interesting to me, and I'd like to try that on. Spoiler alert's a little different. Michael Osceola, actually, though, who wrote the original book it's based on, he came to me to ask if I would do a Q&A with him at Barnes & Noble when the book was launching. And so that's the only reason I read that, is because, again, he came to me, but it was my husband's idea to option it for a movie.
It's about the death of his husband, right?
Yes, the true story of Michael's, the death of his husband, yes, who was a photographer. And I didn't know if that would make a good movie or not. It's nobody else has seen it yet, but it interested me. And this one was because it was so... partly, at least, because there was so much personal connection. I was in a long-term relationship like his. We'd both met in New York City. Both couples had roughly around the same time. There was just a lot. It was very easy to put myself in Michael's shoes.
Yeah.
And then after that, the next thing I'm going to do is a play. I'm going to do a musical at Off-Broadway, the Classic Stage Company, A Man of No Importance. I'm working on that now. And that was, again, I didn't know the play. I had never seen it or read it. I had not seen the movie it was based on, an old Albert Finney film. But John Doyle was directing it, and I had seen his versions of Company and Sweeney Todd, and I adored them. And so I read that play, and I thought, I'm going to have to really not like this to say no, because I want to work with John Doyle. And then I loved it, so that made it very easy. But I don't know. It's just another example of what was in the equation of that one that made it interesting to me, was I wanted to do a play with John Doyle. I loved his. Yeah. I loved what I'd seen.
You left Los Angeles, right, permanently. You now live in New York again.
Yeah.
And on your own terms, of course. But why? Was there a reason? Did you feel like I'm kind of done living in it's a wonderful city. I grew up there. I love LA.
Los Angeles?
I just imagine that being in the entertainment industry there can be challenging. I mean,
Two major things were. When I first started visiting New York, right after college, I had friends who lived here, so I would come for a few days or whatever. And I kind of felt immediately an odd ease with it. I don't know why. Part of it's that New York is built on a grid, so someone who's bad at directions, which I notoriously was very comfortable with that. It was just the energy, and I loved the trains. I loved the subway. It just suited me. And when I first moved here permanently or semi-permanently in 2001, I felt it then too. And Todd and I met here. And so Los Angeles was fun at first because it was new. And then I began quickly missing New York. I think about 3 or 4 years in, I really, really felt it hard. And then I asked my agents to please get me, I remember asking, could you get me, I'll come into town, I'll rent a place, and I'll even do readings for theaters or whatever in the summer. And they ended up getting me a play, and I did that. But that started building back my realization, this is where I really wanted to live, because I take to it. The thing about Los Angeles that for me wasn't as comfortable was that it is such a entertainment business town.
Yeah.
And I enjoy not feeling that in New York as much. I walk around and I hear people talking and
they're not talking about the industry.
I don't know what they're talking about. Yeah. Money, you know, business. I have no idea. Just in general.
Fashion. Yeah.
But it's not the pitch that they're about to go have to sell or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine that, you know, you're executive producing shows like Young Sheldon. And then you're playing these very, very complex roles like the Hollywood agent Henry Wilson, a really kind of a sort of an awful person, right? But also a troubled man.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to imagine that part of what happens is when you do those roles, you stretch, you grow as an actor. Like it triggers creative thinking, right? I mean, I have to imagine that you are also thinking about maybe writing something, maybe coming up with a new concept. I mean, you've come up with Young Sheldon, but, you know, kind of trying a bunch of different things out.
Yes. I, for a long time, thought, largely because people asked me if I was writing anything, I was like, oh, I should probably be writing something. And I mean, I took some writing courses actually online during the pandemic. Yeah. And it is very difficult. And I think it's something I could keep pursuing and working at, even if just for myself and fun. But the biggest thing I enjoy is storytelling. Mm. And that can take a zillion different forms.
Yes.
And so I don't know if that means that I'd like to try directing at some point, or if I'd like to try editing at some point. These are every aspect of filmmaking and TV making and stuff. They are all storytelling methods. And so that intrigues me. I will say that I've always seen myself, and I still feel this intuitively, that I'll probably act until whatever time I can't. And I don't know if that'll be my grave or what, but as much as I sometimes get piqued, my interest gets piqued at the idea of a certain, maybe other aspects of the business, I ultimately know that that's the place in which, well, here, you want to get really deep. That's the one place I know that it feels closest to me talking to God, as it were. Like, that's,
yeah.
I don't always, but sometimes when I am getting to do acting, I can get out of my way and I can see and hear things that I just normally don't get to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a state of flow.
Yeah.
It's like you're sort of entering this form of consciousness where you're so in it in that moment, and you're it's like an out-of-body experience, I would imagine.
I remember we were rehearsing a scene on Big Bang once, and I've never forgotten it because I kind of wasn't thinking about what I was saying. I was just kind of throwing a fit. It was one of those kinds of scenes that I knew how to do it at the table read. I could say it. I could do it always just without thinking about it. But when we were rehearsing it, or when we were performing it for the producers or whatever, I would suddenly start trying to, quote unquote, help. And I was trying to, quote unquote, do my job. And I finally just said, I go, I am so sick of it. It's like there's this little person inside of me and he knows how to do the scene. But if I try and help, he can't do it anymore. And somebody was like, that sounds like acting. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that's true. But it was, in the moment, was so frustrating. I was like, well, I want to get to do it too. And I couldn't, because like you say, in the flow, it kind of isn't the me that I see so clearly in the mirror. It's some sort of other being.
But I mean, clearly it's like that is your, like, your creative outlet. And you talk about storytelling. I mean, it's through those characters, right, that you are, you become this character. Like Sheldon, you're Henry Wilson, you're Mike Osceola. I mean, they're all very different characters. So, I mean, that's your creative outlet. That's how you grow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's many things about the one that I'm thinking of is that when you list them like that, what I think of is that I was like, well, what do they each offer me? Or do I offer them? I don't know which way to look at it. But it's that it's opportunities to view the world and very specific situations and relationships with other humans and dealing with them from their specific point of view. And that's exciting because it allows me to access all those places inside that I either don't have the impulse to in my normal life or ethically know better than to or whatever it is, and get to do that. And with somebody like a Henry Wilson in particular, not unlike how unlikable Sheldon can be, I really, really enjoy the old acting 101 challenge of don't judge the character, and they don't think of themselves as bad. And they can certainly suffer guilt and shame and feel bad about things, but like their overall modus operandi is not, I am a bad person, which is very simple terms. But I mean, it's really, it's to me at least, it's very exciting to get to take on somebody like that who it's easy to see the ways in which they're not leading the best life and go in there and take them on in a way that says, I feel okay about it. This is my best version of me.
You know, I'm interested in becoming a character like Audra McDonald, who's also on the show, talked about how when she gets a role, she does everything she can to understand that character's contextual side. Like she reads books about the period, or she goes to the places where they lived. I mean, you know, Charleston or wherever it is. And that's an intense form of preparation. And not to say that every actor must do that, but to become that character, you know, that Hollywood agent, that sort of very vile, but also troubled, deeply closeted, almost like a Roy Cohn character, mm-hmm. right? What do you do to become that? Are you able to just show up and become him, or do you have to really spend weeks and months thinking about how to become him?
Well, in the case of Henry Wilson, and there was this beautiful biography written. It's called The Man Who Invented Rock Hudson.
Right.
It's a fantastic book. It's
He was Rock Hudson's agent and famously made
That's
Rock
right.
Hudson. Yes.
So he has, it's a beautiful biography. It's very well researched. It's very entertaining while being informative. And so for me in that particular role, it made a lot of things so clear. And it really opened up for me how much enjoyment I get out of playing real people like that, because there is so much to look at. You know, one of the hardest things about getting into the situation of the character you're playing, if they're not a real person, is even just remembering all the questions you need to ask yourself of, oh yeah, what do they eat for breakfast? Oh yeah, what? It's like when it's a real person, you can sometimes get this wealth of information that just throws it all at you and feeds into your subconscious. And the same was true in when I was doing Spoiler Alert with the, yeah. you know, the Michael Osceola book was factual. Also, I could still ask him questions if I needed to, but I really didn't need to. He had done such a good job describing where he was in his life, where he'd been, that led up to this time and during it, that, oh, it's just the best form of research that there is. But I would like to at some point take on a role that I felt required or the opportunity to, like, I don't know, go to a weird situation. I shouldn't say weird, but like visit a place that, you know, you hear about people going, well, I went and spent a week in whatever prison or whatever. I'm like, oh, God. did she really?
Went to the International Space Station for a month.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have to be careful what you wish for. But yeah.
Do you think that the concept of creativity is, you know, it's this abstract idea, and I think we place a lot of this mysterious kind of aura around it, you know, that it's this gift or this intangible. It is intangible, I guess, but do you think it's something that anybody can cultivate? I mean, you were in high school and elementary school and college theater, so you worked with a lot of people. It is, and not just actors, but people building sets and people directing and people writing. I mean, there's, you know, you work in a creative space full of creative people, and I wonder whether over the course of your career and your observations, you've kind of come to any conclusions about how creativity works.
I'll tell you the thing that has altered my take on creativity more than anything was finally working through a book that I had not poo-pooed, but I'm like, I don't think that's for me. It was, which is The Artist's Way, the Julia Cameron book. Mm-hmm. And I started that book right as we were wrapping up Big Bang, because I thought, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do next. Not like I'm leaving acting, but like I don't specifically know. Again, back to the life of uncertainty. I don't know what I'm going to do next. And I want to do whatever I can to make sure I'm open to as wide a range of possibilities mentally and emotionally as I can be, so that I don't miss, because of blinders on in some way, the thing that I really, that would call to my heart the most. And so I started doing The Artist's Way, and I do think that has really convinced me that creativity really lies in the everyday. I mean, she goes into this a lot, but I think it's very true, and I feel it for myself. It's the great ideas for yourself. I'm not saying that change the world necessarily, but the great ideas come when you are washing the dishes. They come when you're sitting in traffic. They come when you're watering the plant. But you have to like actively participate is I guess what I'm saying. It's like, you know, the time, like I went through a period. We were wrapping up the post-production on the movie, and the play was sitting far enough in front of me that I didn't need to be looking at it yet. And I spent a few weeks kind of floating around and vacationing and just taking care of some other things. And suddenly the play became for me, the musical, very daunting and very scary. And even to the point I went, wait a minute, why did I do this? Forget John Doyle, you know. And then when I finally sat down and just started methodically kind of going through it and just singing out loud to one song at a time and printing it out, whatever, that's when the excitement started to build again, and that's when the ideas started to come again. It wasn't magical. It wasn't. There was nothing flashy about it. It was so mundane. It was paperwork. It was rhythmical, physical. I mean, it's just like, and that was where, for me at least at this point, the birth of that. And it's always the case. The hardest thing is getting started, because the dream of what you want something to be is so big and beautiful, and to have to start working on it requires you to shatter it and rebuild it to actually make it happen, and it won't look exactly like what you thought. But that's so scary to get to dive in and start realizing how far you have to go to get to the dream you want to be living.
That's actor Jim Parsons. By the way, The Big Bang Theory taped 279 episodes in its 12-year run. And of all those shows, Jim says his favorites were the ones where Sheldon had to conquer his fears, like ornithophobia, the irrational fear of birds, or glossophobia, the fear of public speaking. To see the show notes for this episode, go to thegreatcreators.com/Parsons.
Hey,
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Hey, thanks so much for listening to our episode this week. We have one ask. Please help us spread the word and tell people to listen to The Great Creators. You can find us on social media by searching for The Great Creators. This episode was produced by Avery Keeley and edited by Andrea Bruce with help from Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Elaine Coates, Kevin Leahy, Jenna Gedman, Nat Hoops, Michael May, Michelle Triant, and Daniel Shukin. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.